Good morning. I'd like to welcome you to Grand Rounds. I'm Dr. Ken Rosenthal, and I'm chairman of CME. And Dr. John Rubin's here with me, my vice chairman. I'd like to introduce our guest speaker, Dr. Seth Baum. Dr. Baum is a graduate of Columbia College and Columbia College of Physicians and Surgeons. He completed training in internal medicine, cardiology, and interventional cardiology and electrophysiology. He's directed and founded multiple cardiac catheterization electrophysiology laboratories. He's worked extensively in integrative cardiology, directing the Boca Raton Division of Harvard's Mind-Body Medicine Institute. He's an associate affiliate professor of medicine at FAU Medical School and has a practice in Boca Raton that's devoted solely to clinical lipidology. He's board certified by the American Board of Clinical Lipidology and Cardiovascular Disease Prevention. He also founded and directs the only lipoprotein apheresis program in Southeast Florida. He lectures both nationally and internationally in emphasizing familial hypercholesterolemia, ASCVD prevention, lipid disorders and evolving therapies, integrative cardiology, sex distinctions in cardiovascular disease, and omega-3 fatty acids. Dr. Baum's topic this morning is clinical trials, what's current, and why participate. It's with great pleasure I present Dr. Baum.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you very much. That was an old bio, but I appreciate it very much. And I just want to clarify one thing. Also, the president of the American Society for Preventive Cardiology, any of you who want to go to the meeting, it's in 4 weeks in Fort Lauderdale, and also the chief medical officer of Excel Medical Clinical Trials. So today we're going to be doing something a little different. I really appreciate all of you sitting in the back row, too. It makes this much more. It's okay. Today we're going to do something a little different. The topic's on clinical research. And I thought, you know, how do you make this topic a little less dry? Because it can be dry. So what I decided to do was talk about clinical research, talk about what we're doing in clinical research. We have a number of very interesting clinical trials. And also show you some disease states to enable you to be more familiar with them, but also to emphasize why we're doing the clinical trials, because of these disease states. So these are my disclosures. There are four phases of clinical trials. I'm sure you've all heard this. Phase one, this is typically a first-in-human clinical trial, has a small number of people, focuses on safety. So safety is the key here. Pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics are evaluated. And once safety is established, we can move on to a phase two clinical trial, more people, looking at both safety and efficacy, and you can have up to several hundred people in these trials. Subsequently, you go on to bigger trials, the phase three clinical trials. And in the phase three clinical trials, some of them are called pivotal, because these are the trials that are outcomes trials, typically, at least nowadays, that the FDA utilizes to make a decision whether to bring a drug to market or not. Right, those are the phase three clinical trials. And phase four is after a drug has been approved by the FDA with its various indications, the drug can still be further studied. So this is after FDA approval. This is very interesting, actually. So in many different surveys, this is just one of them, people have been asked, subjects have been asked why they participate in clinical trials. And the top two reasons are actually altruistic, which is, to me, very interesting. To advance medicine is the number one reason, and to help others, to improve the lives of others, is number two. Then we start getting into the more personal matters or issues, such as to help themselves, to get better health care. When people are in clinical trials, when they're participating in clinical trials, they do receive improved healthcare because they're constantly being monitored. There are multiple layers of monitoring, and quite a lot of lab work is done on these people and a lot of examinations. Some people do this to receive money because you do get paid. Typically, you get paid not in NIH trials, not in the government-funded trials, but in other clinical trials they get paid. The components of a research site, it's a little more complex than people realize. The regulatory aspects are enormous and growing. So there are multiple layers of a clinical site. Obviously, we have a lot of equipment. The equipment has to be calibrated regularly. We have our study participants. We have our staff, which is clinical research coordinators, clinical research assistants. We have the PI, principal investigator, the sub-investigators. And we also have a regulatory staff. And the regulatory staff is really important because you have to do everything right. This is not a game for those of us who are not incredibly obsessive compulsive, because you get nailed otherwise. We have a number of different visits, a pre-site visit that's before the trial actually starts. You're evaluated by whomever the sponsor is, and they say, hey, can you actually pull this off? Okay, do you have enough subjects? Do you have enough patients in your database? Do you have enough experience in this realm? So that's a pre-site visit. And then if you pass, you get a site initiation visit. They come. We sit there for about 6 hours looking at a slide deck and discussing the clinical trial. There's an investigator's brochure, which is this gigantic thing that I have to read every time we have a clinical trial. And then we have multiple visits during the conduct of a clinical trial. Okay, they keep coming, they sit there, they ask us questions. Tremendous regulation. Currently, we're in over 20 clinical trials. You see most of them deal with lipids, LDL, triglycerides, lipoprotein small a, okay, and different disease states in these lipid disorders, with these lipid disorders. We're also dealing with NASH, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, and we have a couple of trials there. We have trials in diabetes, in heart failure, and so a lot of, frankly, quite interesting stuff. So what I want to do now is move into the clinical. So, why are we doing this, all right? So I've already told you we're going to evaluate ways to lower LDL, lower triglycerides, lower LP little a. I don't know how many of you order LP little a, but you're going to see why you should order LP little a. And also inflammation. We all hear about inflammation and vascular disease. Well, should we really study this? And the answer is yes. And the answer often comes in terms of an evolution of association to causation. And we'll make that distinction in a few minutes. So let's look first at the history of LDL, and let's look at the history of cholesterol. LDL and cholesterol, first of all, they're different, okay, and often people will conflate them, and that's a major error, and it's caused a lot of confusion, not only among us, but among our patients as well. Over the years, various lines of evidence have demonstrated, from biology to epidemiology to pathophysiology, the RCTs and Mendelian randomization studies, that LDL does cause vascular disease. It's no longer a hypothesis. So everybody in this room should leave here saying the LDL hypothesis is dead. It's now the LDL truth. And we have enough evidence, and I'll show you more of that. So higher LDL equates to higher cardiovascular risk. Lower LDL, lower risk. Lowering LDL lowers risk. Raising LDL raises risk. So let's look at the history of cholesterol. In 1913, a medical student in Russia named Anichkov was the first to demonstrate some potential causation, but clearly association, between the consumption of cholesterol and the development of plaque. And what he did was he fed a bunch of rabbits regular rabbit chow, and then he fed some other rabbits a high cholesterol diet. He sacrificed the rabbits, and he found that those who were fed high cholesterol diets actually had developed plaque in their aortas. So he was the first guy, a medical student, was the first guy to show this relationship. Then we move along to Framingham, which started in the late 40s, became much bigger in the 60s. William Cannell came up with the term risk factor for cholesterol, and that was out of Framingham. 1985, Goldstein and Brown won the Nobel Prize for their work on the LDL receptor. And then in 1987, lovastatin was released as the first statin therapy, and then multiple clinical trials have occurred since that time on statins and other agents. Back to some basic biology and physiology, how do we get an LDL particle? Well, the liver manufactures VLDL particles, very low-density lipoprotein particles, which contain predominantly triglycerides, about 80% triglycerides. And they have a purpose in humans, a real purpose. And their purpose is to go around the body and deliver their triglycerides to various organs so that the organs can use the triglycerides as energy, either as energy at the time or store energy. As they do this, they shrink down and they become smaller and smaller, and they turn into IDL particles, intermediate density lipoprotein particles. They have a very short residence time in the body. They go around, do the same thing, deliver some triglycerides or go directly to the liver for degradation. And what happens when their triglycerides leave? They become smaller. They become LDL particles. So what do LDL particles do in the body? Well, they contain mostly cholesterol, and a lot of people think that they deliver their cholesterol to various components of the body, but that's just not true. Not in humans, not in modern humans. In fact, they don't deliver cholesterol at all. They just get degraded. So the purpose of an LDL particle in a human, in a modern human, is to be degraded. We do know, however, that cholesterol is very important in many biologic functions, the creation of bile acids, steroidogenesis, many, many things. Cholesterol is in every single cell membrane. Cholesterol is important in neural function and brain function. But again, remember, cholesterol is not the same as LDL, and that's a really important distinction. So here's a cell, and how does a cell get cholesterol? Well, a cell could get it externally. It can bring it in because it has a variety of receptors on its surface, but it can also manufacture cholesterol. And in the human, every single cell in our body can manufacture cholesterol, every one of them. So if we look at animal data, it's interesting to note that when it comes to steroidogenesis, the acquisition of cholesterol is done predominantly through HDL and through de novo synthesis, not at all or very little through LDL acquisition. So even in animals, LDL doesn't have a major role for the acquisition of cholesterol. Many, many studies, this is just one, have looked at statins and their impact on our ability to manufacture steroidal hormones, and it really doesn't exist. So in other words, you're on a statin, you're going to be just fine from a steroidogenesis standpoint. The brain is the scariest aspect of lipid lowering. Everybody's afraid we're going to damage our brains by lowering our lipids. But it turns out that the brain is segregated. We all know about the blood-brain barrier. Well, it's segregated from the rest of the body with respect to lipoproteins. So LDL particles don't cross the blood-brain barrier. They never get to the brain. Right? So you don't have to worry about a low LDL and your brain. In fact, the brain is entirely dependent upon de novo synthesis of cholesterol, entirely. And that's really to protect the brain. So if blood levels of lipids fall, the brain, which requires so much cholesterol, just makes its own. So we see that our understanding of LDL and cholesterol has evolved over the years. You can see from Anichkow forward, we have RCTs. We understand cholesterol acquisition. We understand the fact that cells are not dependent upon LDL. That's very important, and we should never conflate LDL with cholesterol. All right, that's a major error. So in humans, modern humans, as I said before, LDL is marked solely for degradation. That's it. We now have our randomized controlled trials, many of them with statin therapies, showing that lower LDL is better. And this is the Cholesterol Treatment Trialists Collaboration, CTTC. And that showed very convincingly a cause and effect relationship between lowering LDL and decreasing cardiovascular event rates. So for every millimole reduction in LDL, and a millimole is just under 40 milligrams per deciliter, for every millimole reduction in LDL, you have a 22% reduction in cardiovascular events. And that's a phenomenon that occurs repeatedly, continuously, always. It's a very consistent phenomenon. We should all know that. Every millimole reduction in LDL leads to a 22% reduction in cardiovascular events. This is based on 26 clinical trials. Ezetimibe was then studied in Improve It, and because people were saying, hey, you know, this is a statin phenomenon. There are pleiotropic effects to statins. It's all the pleiotropic effects, anti-inflammatory, anti-apoptotic, et cetera, et cetera. And so ezetimibe was studied in Improve It and had the exact same finding. Every millimole reduction in LDL, 22% reduction in cardiovascular event rates, and it fell right on the line of regression. So these litany of studies have proved causation, but we can actually go further than that. In cardiology, we do have this problem. And this is, I think, a kind of humorous statement by David Brown, that we have a history of finding a marker of a bad outcome and treating that marker of the bad outcome as if it were the cause of the bad outcome. Okay, we do that all the time. We did it with PVCs, and we've done it with a lot of other things. We don't want to make that mistake. So, in a sense, what we're doing is... Now everything's better. What we're doing is conflating association and causation. And just like we didn't want to conflate LDL and cholesterol, we don't want to do it here either. So we have to find a better way to further prove causation. So some examples of errors would be gray hair. So gray hair is associated with cardiovascular disease. We all know that. You know, a lot of our patients who come in with heart attacks have gray hair. Therefore, people say, well, you know, gray hair causes atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. And no, that's not true. It's just that older people tend to have gray hair and older people tend to have heart disease. And there's an association, but it's not causal. There's a little caveat there. There was a recent study that showed that premature graying does predict cardiovascular, premature heart disease. So I'm not sure what that means. But let's just say this is just associative. Reverse causation. This is also a very common error in the literature. The great example is low cholesterol and cancer. Low cholesterol is associated with cancer. So a lot of people on the internet all over the place say, well, low cholesterol causes cancer. It's the opposite. Cancer causes low cholesterol. That's reverse causation. So we have these studies called Mendelian randomization studies. And the rationale is as follows. Genotypes are not modified by disease. It limits reverse causation. Okay, if a disease is not going to change your genotype, that would have been reverse causation if it did. They're also assigned randomly at meiosis. And the random assortment is called Mendel's Law of Independent Assortment. The random assignment of these genotypes and mutations specifically is what we're talking about, are single nucleotide polymorphisms, is like a randomization, if you would, in a clinical trial. But it's better, okay, because there are no confounders. So the requirements here from a Mendelian randomization study are that the mutation or the SNP affects only the biomarker, nothing else. Okay, it can't have multiple effects because then you get confounding. And the same the genetic variant has to associate with the disease state that we're looking at in the same direction, i.e., let's talk about LDL. If LDL goes up because of a mutation, well, vascular disease has to go up as well. Okay, it can't go down. Then you're not going to prove causation. And we also have to separate out exogenous or environmental factors, and they have to be randomly distributed. You can't emphasize environmental factors on one side or another. These are the three components of any Mendelian randomization study: the instrument, which is the mutation or the SNP, right? And that's the thing that we're looking at that causes a change in one biomarker. We have a theoretically predicted risk estimate and an observed risk estimate, and they have to be concordant, all right? So we have to satisfy these criteria. If you look here in the upper left at A, you'll see that we have vascular disease, and we have a couple of different biomarkers pointing toward vascular disease. But these biomarkers are affected by both endogenous, i.e. genetic influences, and exogenous, or environmental influences. So we cannot determine in this situation that there is a causation, that there is a causal relationship. In the upper right, in B, we can, because all we have is a mutation that causes an elevation in a biomarker, and it goes in the same direction as the disease state. And it does just that without affecting any other phenotypes. So that proves that's a Mendelian randomization causation. Now, interestingly, this slide will maybe disturb some of you, maybe not. But if you look at the positive studies, these are the things that passed Mendelian randomization. We have LDL. Okay, so yes, every single study that has looked at a mutation or a SNP that affects LDL has been a positive Mendelian randomization study. The same with LP little a, actually, lipoprotein small a, which we're going to talk about a study. So LDL, worth studying. LPAA, worth studying. Triglycerides, which a few years back we said were just innocent bystanders, or guilty bystanders, rather, actually are causal agents. So triglycerides, they pass Mendelian randomization. What doesn't pass Mendelian randomization? Look on the left and you'll see HDL. So although we say HDL is the good cholesterol and we should raise our HDL so that we can thwart heart disease and stroke, the reality is every single Mendelian randomization study that's looked at it has proved that HDL does not, in one way or another, have a causal relationship with ASCVD. The RCTs also prove the same. Now, there is one RCT that's going to be published in a week in Europe that was with a CETP inhibitor that did have a positive outcome, the only one out of four studied. But it has multiple effects. It lowers Lp(a), it lowers LDL, and it does raise HDL. So we cannot infer from that study that this is an HDL phenomenon, and all the evidence points to otherwise, to not being an HDL phenomenon. The other positive Mendelian randomization study I want to point your attention to is inflammation, IL-6. So inflammation is causally related to vascular disease. This is what a Mendelian randomization study looks like. You see these three different genetic profiles of these patients. You have CC, CT, TT. This is a single nucleotide polymorphism. And so you have the heterozygous form, the CT, and the homozygous form of the polymorphism, that's TT. And these lower LDL. So you would anticipate that this would decrease cardiovascular disease risk, right, the event rates. And you would also anticipate that the heterozygous form, which has a less of an impact on lowering LDL, would do so in a more blunted fashion than the homozygous form. And so let's see what happens. There are six different trials in which these SNPs were evaluated. And on the left, you see the heterozygous form, and on the right, you see the homozygous form. And you see very clearly that in all six of these trials, there's a reduction in event rates, as you would anticipate, and they all move farther to the left, meaning there's a greater impact with the homozygosity than with heterozygosity. All right? So this is proving, this is Mendelian randomization proving LDL's causal relationship to vascular disease. So again, get rid of LDL hypothesis from our lexicon. We have multiple lines of evidence that have proved that it's not a hypothesis, it's a fact. We have all these studies, Fourier I'm going to talk about in a moment. We have Mendelian randomization. Now, PCSK9. I know, well, for the residents here, I don't know how many of you have had the experience of using a PCSK9 inhibitor. I know we have a lot of constraints from our payers, so perhaps not, but you'll see why it's so important. So this is PCSK9. In 2003, its gene was identified, and PCSK9 was very rapidly seen to be an important regulator of LDL metabolism. And PCSK9 is made in the liver. It's in the endoplasmic reticulum. It has five components. It's released as a zymogen, which means it needs to be autocleaved in order to be active. And it undergoes autocleavage in the endoplasmic reticulum. The top two components are chopped off. The second of those two components, actually, though, comes back on itself and binds to the catalytic site. So this proprotein convertase subtilisin kexin type 9, the ninth in the series of these proproteins, when it's released from the Golgi into the blood, loses its catalytic ability. It's no longer as an enzyme. It's just a binding protein. And all it does is bind LDL receptors on the surface of hepatocytes, and I'll show you what that does. This is how LDL is degraded under normal circumstances. We see that LDL has a very large apolipoprotein called ApoB100 that weaves its way in and out of the surface of LDL particles, also on VLDL and IDL particles. Remember, LDL came from VLDL, and it's there in a one-to-one relationship. A portion of the ApoB serves as a ligand for the LDL receptor and will bind the LDL receptor on the hepatocyte and then will be taken in a clathrin-coated pit and brought into an endosome. In the late stage of endosome development, you have a drop in the pH. And when the pH drops, it actually separates the LDL receptor from the LDL particle. The LDL receptor goes back to the surface of the cell. And it can do it 100, 150 times. And imagine what that means. It means each LDL receptor has the capacity to bring in 100, 150 LDL particles for degradation. What happens to the LDL particle? It goes to a lysosome and gets degraded. So I told you that PCSK9 is a binding protein, and here it is binding, and it binds to the LDL receptor. Now the LDL particle comes in, binds to the LDL receptor at a different site. Now you have two things on the LDL receptor, the LDL particle, the PCSK9, and then the third is the LDL receptor. Taken into the clathrin-coated pit, go into the endosome, pH drops, LDL receptor is supposed to separate from the LDL particle, but it doesn't, because PCSK9 acts as glue. It increases the affinity of the LDL receptor to the LDL particle by 100 to 150 fold and sticks the two of them together. Everything is shunted off to the lysosome. Everything is degraded. We lose the opportunity for recycling of the LDL receptor. And what happens to the LDL in the blood? It goes up because we have fewer receptors. So some very smart people, this is Conan Hobbs at UT Southwestern, looked at mutations and single nucleotide polymorphisms affecting PCSK9 to see whether or not these mutations did translate into a change in cardiovascular risk and into a change in LDL. And in fact, ARIC, which was Atherosclerotic Risk in Communities study, very large study, showed that it did. And here is a SNP that affects African Americans, lowers LDL quite significantly, and lowers risk of ASCVD by 88%. Here's another loss of function mutation in Caucasians, lowers LDL a little less so, lowers risk by 47% because of a lower reduction in LDL. So they both moved in the same direction that they should and were affecting vascular disease to the extent that would have been anticipated by their reduction. So those are loss of function mutations that do a good thing. Other people started looking for them. Other people found them. In fact, one person was identified as a homozygote for two PCSK9 loss of function mutations with compound heterozygote, a different one from mother and father. Both had the same effect of dropping PCSK9. Dropped it so low that this person, a woman, middle-aged woman, has an LDL of 14. And she's perfectly healthy, no vascular disease, but also nothing else. Nothing else that you would worry about, no brain effects, no steroidogenic effects, nothing. Okay, she's perfectly healthy. And so we have many of these examples of loss of function mutations now in very healthy populations with a much lower risk of vascular disease. So what do you do next? Well, you look for gain of function mutations. And here we have a number of gain of function mutations. These came later. And these also showed something very interesting. They developed the phenotype of FH, familial hypercholesterolemia, with extensor tendon xanthoma, corneal arcus, early vascular disease, premature death from heart attack, the same phenotype. So this is another mutation that causes FH. It's not just the LDL receptor. Now we have PCSK9 also. We also have ApoB that does it. And we see this in multiple different populations, different mutations that are gain-of-function PCSK9 mutations. So we see the relationship here, higher PCSK9 from a gain of function mutations, higher LDL, higher risk of vascular disease, lower PCSK9 from loss of function mutations, lower LDL, lower risk of vascular disease. Again, cause and effect. A giant trial was recently published. This trial is called Fourier. This is an outcomes trial that was event-driven. In other words, you pick the number of events prior to the start of the trial, you say, this is the number of events we have to achieve, and then the trial stops. The event rate was much higher in the placebo arm than had been anticipated, and consequently, the trial was much shorter than had been hoped. But it still did, it still was a positive study. Both primary and secondary endpoints were positive. This was a key secondary endpoint. The classic triple mace of non-fatal MI and stroke and mortality. And we see that there is a significant relative risk reduction and absolute risk reduction here, so the trial was positive, okay? But if you notice where the lines start separating, where the curves start separating from one another, it's at 6 months. This is very common. It actually always happens in lipid-lowering trials. It takes a long time for effect to start occurring. But if in a short trial, that creates a problem. You don't have enough time to demonstrate mortality benefit. And this trial has been criticized because of that. It's really not an issue of the trial. It's an issue of the phenomenon of lipid lowering. And in fact, in that meta-analysis I showed you of 26 statin trials, only three of them actually had mortality benefit. The rest did not. And those three were the early ones that were placebo-controlled against truly no background therapy at all. Okay, these people were very poorly treated because it was in the 90s. So this is, to me, an unnecessary criticism. But when you have such a thing where you have a delayed response in your separation of curves, you can do these things called landmark analyses where you start the clock basically at month 12, okay? And you start seeing what the effect would be downstream. And here you see this 25% relative risk reduction on the right, and here a 33% relative risk reduction when looking at MI and stroke, both fatal and non-fatal. And interestingly, they fall very much at 2 years, actually, fall very much on the same curve, if you look at the top, major coronary events, as the CTTC. So the event reduction looks like it's exactly the same, with that millimole reduction in LDL cholesterol leading to a 22% reduction in event rates. Just to show you safety, because you should always show safety whenever you show efficacy. That's one of the trial things that we have to do. The thing you worry about most would be neurocognitive decline, because everybody's afraid of the brain, right? When we lowered LDLs, the average LDL in the treated patient population was 30, okay? So people were worried about that before the trial. There was not even a signal here. There's nothing, okay? It didn't have any impact. And really, knowing what we now know, you would not have anticipated that there would have been an impact. There were a few binding antibodies, but no neutralizing antibodies identified. And the only issue here really is injection site reactions, a little higher in the drug arm than in the placebo arm. So just to summarize PCSK9, we understand what PCSK9 does. PCSK9, you know, kills the receptor, doesn't actively kill, leads to the destruction of receptors for LDL on the surface of the hepatocyte. We saw the mutations, and we see that this is a great therapeutic target, and we now have two PCSK9 inhibitors available for our patients. Now, based on all this stuff, I'm going to just show you a few clinical trials that are kind of interesting. This is one. This kind of depresses me. I recently had surgery, so I can't fly yet, and this is a trial that we did that's being presented at the European meetings next week as a late breaker, and I was going to present it, so I'm very sad about that. But it was really cool. Very complex design, looking at apheresis and seeing whether or not we can actually take people off apheresis by using PCSK9 inhibitors. The trial's embargoed, so I can't tell you definitively what happened, but I can tell you that my apheresis program is less than half of what it used to be. So you can figure that one out for yourselves. This is what apheresis looks like. This is a chair and a machine next to the chair. This is what the filter looks like after apheresis. It's white initially, so that is all fat. It's pretty nasty. And we see this great reduction in LDL cholesterol. The problem with apheresis is you get this very rapid rebound. That's one of the problems. The other problem is every 2 weeks you got to come in and have large bore, you know, IVs stuck in you, so it's not too much fun. And it takes a few hours. So it's nice to have an alternative to apheresis. Very nice. There are other drugs we look at for LDL lowering. And, you know, what I often hear is, oh, my God, we have the statins. Don't we have enough? You know, why do we need more drugs? Well, because there's a lot of statin intolerance out there. A lot of people can't tolerate it. A lot of people don't get to goal. If you look at the NHANES data, in fact, most recent NHANES data, people in America with ASCVD, only 20% have an LDL under 70. 20%. So 80% of ASCVD patients in America are not adequately treated. So we do need other therapies. So this is something called bempedoic acid, or ETC-1002, and we're in a number of these clinical trials looking at, obviously, LDL lowering, but in a variety of different conditions, ASCVD, non-ASCVD, statin intolerance, you know, non-statin intolerance. Triple therapy with Atorva and ezetimibe. So all sorts of different varieties, variations on the theme. One of the interesting things, actually two interesting things about bempedoic acid, it works only in the liver, so we're anticipating fewer of the off-target effects from the statins, i.e. the muscle effects. It also lowers CRP, but we learned before, if you looked at the Mendelian randomization slide, you might have noticed that CRP was on the wrong side. So CRP is not causally related. It is associated with vascular disease, but not causally related. And although there's a 44% reduction in CRP here, it's not clear what that's going to mean. This is the mechanism of action. You see it works only in a hepatocyte. It's a prodrug converted to the active form in the hepatocyte and then blocks the metabolism or the production of cholesterol right at the top, right at the origin of the pathway. We also have another drug called gemcobine, and this now has multiple effects. Gemcobine lowers LDL and triglyceride, but remember, triglyceride causes vascular disease, and LDL causes vascular disease. So another therapeutic agent. This has multiple different mechanisms of action affecting VLDL production, upregulating LDL receptors. So it really has many, many different effects, and it's unclear if it does work, okay, which is being studied, what the dominant effect, what the dominant benefit is going to come from. Okay, is it going to be triglyceride lowering? Is it going to be LDL lowering? Not so sure, but certainly there's a lot of promise in a drug like this. This is probably our coolest trial. It's a first-in-human trial done with the University of Pennsylvania, and it's gene therapy. So in homozygous FH, familial hypercholesterolemia, the major mutation that causes homozygous FH affects the LDL receptor. And since it's homozygous, it means mother and father have both given a mutation to the offspring. All right, and that mutation is in the LDL receptor. You now have either a severely defective or a completely non-functional, i.e. a null receptor. These people have LDLs over 400. They get infarcts sometimes before the age of 10. I have patients who've had infarcts in their teens. They can have supravalvular aortic stenosis. It's a horrible disease. So in this study, we're injecting a gene, the LDL receptor gene, that's being taken to the liver through the virus AAV8. That's the vector. And there are only 8 people that are going to be in this this phase 1 trial, but it's kind of cool just to be a part. This is I already told you Lp(a) is causal. Now, you'll hear a lot of people say, well, we shouldn't check Lp(a) because there's nothing we can do for Lp(a). Well, that's not necessarily the case. And I know we all learn that in medical school and residency. You know, don't test something unless you can do something about it. There is something we could do about this, not directly, but indirectly. So if you test a patient and a patient has a very high Lp(a), you know that Lp(a) causes vascular disease, you're going to do everything imaginable to lower risk in that patient. And that means driving the LDL way down, much lower than you would otherwise have driven it. All right? And you're also going to influence that patient and say to that patient, you have a mutation that's going to give you premature vascular disease. We got to do everything, lose weight, exercise, et cetera, et cetera. So you will get a benefit out of testing for Lp(a). But now we're testing this agent. This is what an Lp(a) looks like, by the way. I'll just tell you very quickly. It's like a little mini LDL particle. It's got an ApoB100 on it, and then it has this tail called ApoA, and it has multiple units called Kringle repeats, and we're going after the ApoA because that's an integral part of the Lp(a) lipoprotein particle. Lp(a) also, in addition to being atherogenic, is also prothrombotic, so it's kind of extremely bad. And this is being done through antisense technology. And you have two different types of drugs here. We see DNA, we see transcription, we see messenger RNA, and then translation. And then you form a protein, and that's how this works. That protein, in this case, is a disease-related protein. Small molecules, which are our common drugs, are used to combat the disease-related protein. Different with antisense oligonucleotides. Here, we have the DNA, then we get the mRNA. We now take a very short strand that's more similar to DNA, but it's very short, maybe 20, 30 bases long. It goes to the liver. It attaches in a complementary fashion to the mRNA for that disease-related protein, and it blocks production of the protein. You no longer make the protein. In this case, it's ApoA. The antisense oligonucleotides really represent the third phase in drug development, small molecules first, biologics second, and then antisense third. They're very specific. There are no drug-drug interactions known. The CYP system is not involved here, and blood-brain barriers are not issues. This is just to show you that over just the few years of development, we're now on iteration number 3 of the antisense oligonucleotides, and that's with GalNAc. GalNAc is attached to this little small strand of nucleotides. It's attached to it to help lower the dose of the drug, increase the interval of dosing, and therefore potentially, and it looks like it's doing it, decrease side effects. This goes into the liver. It's rapidly removed. The antisense oligonucleotide goes to the nucleus, binds the mRNA. RNA ACE cleaves the double-stranded mRNA plus ASO because that's not natural. That's not what nature wants to see. And we don't make the disease-related protein. In this case, again, ApoA. In its first study, by the way, it dropped Lp(a) 90%. We're also involved in the triglyceride world, and I told you again, triglycerides do cause vascular disease. Strength is one of them. Strength is looking at an omega-3 fatty acid product. That's a free fatty acid form. It's an outcomes trial, and it's now closed, actually. And so far, it passed its data safety monitoring board, and this should be reported next year. But CS7, this is using another antisense oligonucleotide, volanesorsen, which affects the translation of ApoC3. And ApoC3 is integrally involved in triglyceride metabolism. ApoC3 thwarts the metabolism of triglycerides. There's a disease state called FCS, familial chylomicronemia syndrome. It's got about 100 different names. It's type 1 hyperlipidemia. That's what most of us know it as. And it's a devastating disease. These people have triglycerides well over 880. 880 is the magic number, by the way. If you ever see a person's blood test and they have a fasting triglyceride of 880 or above, they, by definition, have chylomicrons in the blood. You can't have a triglyceride of 880 without having chylomicrons. You can't do it just on the basis of VLDL. So that's a very important number to remember. But what happens to these people? They get lactescent plasma, and we've looked at some of these patients' plasma. It is unbelievably frightening. You draw their blood, and 2/3 of their blood is fat. Okay, it's terrifying, I have to tell you. They get a skin eruption, eruptive xanthomas. That's painful. Whereas tendon xanthomas in FH population, those thickening of the Achilles tendon and the extensor tendons on the hands are not painful typically. These are very painful. They're triglyceride-filled little tiny papules, these erythematous papules. And they also can affect their retina, lipemia retinalis. But they probably most significantly get vascular disease and pancreatitis. This is what happens. We have a chylomicron. Lipoprotein lipase will degrade it. If you don't have lipoprotein lipase, you will not cleave your triglyceride and free the fatty acids, and you get very high levels and get in trouble. These are the 5 different genes that are most common. LPL, lipoprotein lipase, represents 90% of the causes of familial chylomicronemia syndrome. So we always make a differential. You see somebody with hypertriglyceridemia, you always have to say, well, wait a second. Is this FCS or is this something else? Is it diabetes? Is it alcoholism? Is it severe central obesity? You have to look at that. Remember, though, to get a triglyceride over 880 in the fasting state, you really do have to think of FCS. Okay? The management goals are pretty clear. We want to decrease our triglycerides and alleviate the symptoms that come from triglycerides, and we want to avoid pancreatitis. Unfortunately, there are no current FDA-approved drugs that really help FCS patients. None of our triglyceride-lowering drugs are very effective in these people, so we need another agent, and that's why we're studying volanesorsen. How do we treat these people when we see them in our practice? Diet. It's all about diet. So we know that sugar is important for triglyceride production in the liver, right? So we reduce sugar when we have hypertriglyceridemic patients, but that's really affecting VLDL. Chylomicrons, you saw, are made in the gut, and they're not affected by sugar consumption. They're affected solely by fat consumption. So you limit the fat intake of these people dramatically. They're on a horrific diet. It's a terrible, terrible diet. But if they adhere to it, it can reduce the risk of hepatosplenomegaly, pancreatitis, vascular disease, etc. So when we look at pancreatitis, you have to know that high triglycerides is the third leading cause of acute pancreatitis. I think number 10 or 11 is the South American scorpion. I remember that from medical school, so that's very important for everybody to remember that. Gallstones and alcoholism obviously is way up there. And this is the theoretical mechanism of action of pancreatitis in hypertriglyceridemic state. We have basically autodigestion of the pancreas from activation of pancreatic enzymes and from clogging of the capillary bed with these very, very large chylomicron particles. Remember I told you that the blood is like literally like cream. It's really truly terrifying. Inflammation. Remember IL-6 from the Mendelian randomization studies? IL-6 is a causal agent when it comes to vascular disease. So there are two different inflammation studies that have been done by Paul Ridker out of Harvard. This is CERT. It's an NIH study. We're part of it. It's with methotrexate. We see that, and this is looking at CRP. CRP does track with vascular disease. It is not causal, though, but it gives us a hint that inflammation is involved, and we certainly know from pathophysiology that inflammation is a major player in vascular events. Now, just to give some insight into what might happen with the methotrexate trial that we're in, CANTOS was already closed, and CANTOS was an IL-1 monoclonal antibody, anti-IL-1 monoclonal antibody. That closed, and top-line results were released and were positive. So this is the first trial that had positive results at lowering inflammation in patients with vascular disease and decreasing vascular risk. This is going to be released at that conference next week. Very exciting, and this is probably a practice-changing trial. In other words, we probably are now going to head down the road. Instead of just going for LDL, triglycerides, Lp(a), which is important, we're also going to go for inflammation, and you're going to see a lot of anti-inflammatory studies popping up now. And then this is just, I put this up here just because it's kind of cool. This is HFpEF and HFrEF, heart failure with preserved and reduced ejection fraction. And we're studying that with empagliflozin, which is an SGLT2 inhibitor, a diabetes drug. And why is that being studied? Because in the EMPA-REG trial and in other trials using these agents, it was found that the diabetic patients had reduced cardiovascular death on the basis of heart failure reduction. So now this is, that bit of information that came out of those trials is saying, oh, study it here. Okay, let's look at it just for heart failure reduction, extending it beyond the diabetes population. So finally, why do clinical trials? Why be involved? Well, it is a path to cure, okay? Once you identify cause and effect, we need to use our therapeutic agents to attack the causal agent so as not to have the effect that we're trying to thwart. So LDL, triglycerides, Lp(a), inflammation, all of these are valid targets. And finally, people actually want to participate in clinical trials. Thank you. Doctor?
Hydrate them, and their triglycerides rapidly decrease, maybe like 50%, you know, over like a 48-hour period without any specific lipid-lowering medication.
Well, you were probably putting them on insulin too, I bet, back then. And we still do that to activate lipoprotein lipase. So you do the fluids and the insulin, and that's how that works. They were all put on insulin drips.
Not at that time, not necessarily.
No.
Nowadays, yes, but I would see rapid decrease in the triglyceride, and oftentimes a precipitating factor was someone would have subclinical hypertriglyceridemia without pancreatitis, and then be a precipitating event like. Had some alcohol, it may not be an alcoholic, but alcohol is a hydrogen donor, increases triglyceride synthesis. Or women were placing estrogens, and estrogen was a triggering factor to bring them to this threshold where they got the pancreatitis.
Right.
The question I had was when you're talking about mechanistically how the patho-like drugs work, I didn't totally understand the pathophysiology. You said that the receptor and the LDL go inside the cell, and now the whole complex gets degraded, and that raises LDL serum cholesterol. Is that correct?
LDL. It raises LDL.
LDL, right? And then.
This is an antibody against PCSK9 to block PCSK9 from binding to the LDL receptor. If it can't bind to the LDL receptor, then the LDL receptor can recycle the 100-150 times, and you have more LDL receptors to pull in more LDL. That's how it works. It binds the PC. It takes PCSK9 out of the equation.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
I don't know if I misunderstood you. Did you state that statins have no anti-inflammatory?
I did not state that. No. So what I stated was that the initial argument was that statins were unique in their ability to decrease cardiovascular risk because of the pleiotropic effects, because of their anti-inflammatory, anti-apoptotic, antioxidant, et cetera, all these effects. And it turned out that just wasn't true, that if you look at ezetimibe, if you look at PCSK9 inhibitors, in fact, there was a JAMA paper that looked at 16 or 18 different ways to lower LDL. They all do the same thing. It's all on, it's very precise. It's every millimole reduction in LDL leads to a 22% reduction in cardiovascular events. So it's really not the pleiotropic effects. That's all I was trying to say. They do have pleiotropic effects. They are antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, et cetera. And, I'm sure that's not a bad thing, but that's not what's causing them to decrease vascular events. Right. It is. Now, typically they do lower it, but they don't always. CRP is very, very variable, and so it's not a wonderful marker for inflammation, very nonspecific, which is why you have to repeat it, in 2 weeks later in order to say, yes, it's up. But regardless, we know now that CRP is not a causal agent in atherosclerosis or in events. I do check CRP more as a means of kind of showing the patient, look, you have this inflammation that's bad, just to kind of motivate them. But it's not causally related to vascular disease.
And finally, the high-protein diets seem to have lowered cholesterol burdens over time, ironically or paradoxically.
It depends, actually. So it depends on the high-protein diet. Diets are really tricky because there are so many different components to everything we eat. So, we try to say, well, this is all saturated fat or this is all monounsaturated fat, and it's just not the case. So, for example, every oil we consume has polyunsaturated, monounsaturated, and even a little bit of saturated fat. So there's a variety of stuff in it. But so when it comes to a protein diet, a high-protein diet, you can have a high-protein diet that's laden with saturated fat, and that diet will increase LDL. It will also increase HDL, but it will increase LDL. You can have, alternatively, a high-protein diet that's a lean high-protein diet, and that will lower LDL. But the consumption of saturated fat does increase LDL. polyunsaturated fat and monounsaturated fats, they're much more neutral when it comes to LDL.
I thought maybe high protein lowers insulin, lowers triglycerides.
Okay, so that's a triglyceride phenomenon, and that is true too. I was talking about LDL, but yes, from a triglyceride standpoint, that's true as well. So a high protein diet definitely, in all cases, will lower triglycerides, with the exception, I should say, actually, of FCS. So in an FCS patient, it won't do it because they're acquiring or creating chylomicrons, and that's their problem. And that's going to be they're going to be formed in the gut. So a high-protein diet that has fat in it won't do that. That will increase triglycerides. That's the only situation, though, where you're going to get an increase in triglycerides from a high-protein diet. Okay. Well, thank you.
Appreciate it.